Warning. This episode contains frank discussions of race and racism that some may find challenging to listen to. Listener discretion is advised. But it also contains stories of overcoming challenges that some may find to be inspiring. Enjoy.
In this episode, I'm interviewing Dr. Akwatu Kenti, assistant professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health and scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto. This is yet another interview from the Race, Health, and Happiness Vault, because we did this interview over 6 months ago. And so that was before the COVID-19 pandemic hit and before the murder of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis police. But the things that we talk about in this episode are extremely relevant right now, 6 months later. Dr. Akwatu Kenti, he has the most amazing superpower, and that is his optimism. And he takes that from his ancestry, his roots, his Trinidadian African background, and he harnesses that to be able to overcome life's challenges and systemic barriers. Akwatu has also done a wealth of fascinating research on urban gun violence and how this is actually linked to systems of oppression. In a time where we're examining the harms that the police cause in Black communities, we're sometimes ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the violence that exists within our communities. But we've got to talk about all of these different forms of violence, because when it comes down to it, the causes are the same. The root causes are systemic racism and oppression. These factors lead to societal neglect, intergenerational trauma, and the marginalization of Black, Indigenous, and other racialized communities. Akwatu will tell you himself that the solutions to urban gun violence must involve larger societal investment and engagement of the affected communities. This is the kind of information we need to know if we want to move towards positive change. And so we need this wisdom right now, and I'm happy to share it with you, because knowledge is power. And this is what we need as we grapple with these complex issues.
The Race, Health, and Happiness podcast is hosted by Dr. Anya Norum, certified public health physician specialist and family doctor. The views expressed by Dr. O's guests are their own and do not necessarily represent her opinions or those of the podcast. Check out the show notes for more details. And now, here's Dr. O.
Hi, my name is Dr. O, and welcome to my podcast, Race, Health, and Happiness. We live in a world where Black, Indigenous, and other people of color are more and more aware of the blatant and subtle ways that systemic racism impacts our lives. And as a doctor, I'm interested in how that affects people's health. This podcast is about how to stay healthy and happy despite all that noise. I'm so delighted to have one of my previous professors on the mic, Dr. Akwatu Kenti. He is a leader in the Black community, researcher, teacher, and human rights advocate. He was the former senior scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, where he created the Transformative Global Health Program at the center. He's presently assistant professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. Dr. Kenti is going to talk to us about his own personal journey and how he stays healthy and well in a racialized world, and about his research on global mental health and gun violence in Black communities. Dr. Akwatu Kenti, welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, I am so excited. It's been, you know, a few years since I sat in your classroom, so this is nice. Now I'm the boss. So actually, let's start with like my favorite question on this show, because we all have our own personal gifts, and it's good for everybody to hear about them, for us to think about them. So
let me ask you, what is your superpower?
Yeah, I would say that my superpower is my optimistic mindset, which allows me to laugh in crazy situations and precarious situations. I could still think, oh my God, this is crazy. And having an optimistic mindset in the face of overwhelming odds and challenges really, I think, has gotten me out of a range of tricky situations and allowed me to sort of stay afloat when otherwise I would have sunk to the bottom.
Okay. And so where did that start in Trinidad, like as a child and just having that optimism, or did it grow over time?
Yeah, so it grew over time, but, you know, I really take a lot of life's learnings from Trinidadian isms.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the biggest isms I think in my life is laugh and cry does live in the same house.
Okay, laugh and cry does live in the same house. Gotcha.
Which means every day you actually have to sweep the house and sweep out the cry. And, you know, you got to work every day to make sure your house is clean, make sure you are oriented positively to whatever comes your way. It's a daily challenge, just like cleaning your house is a daily challenge. And the two dimensions of life are always in front of you. And you have to decide, what's it going to be today, you know?
And if I'm going to follow your kind of analogy on, you know, the two sides, right? There's the what is it, in the same house, there's the tears and there's the happiness. So, and having that kind of optimism and that smile and trying to be positive, have you had any disadvantages for approaching life that way? Or do you think there have been disadvantages for having that optimism?
Yeah, because there's so many challenges, negative setbacks, you know, and people rightly say, you know, this optimism, is it real? Will it help you in terms of dealing with reality? And I say, yeah, you know, your cup is always half empty or half full. And all optimism says is not to deny that your cup might have a leak, but it's half full. And the question is, how do you save what you have and build on what you have? Maintaining enthusiasm in the face of the odds is what I would say has kept me going through many difficult challenges. But one of the key things I decided many years ago was that I wanted my children to be optimistic. Okay. And I realized that if I wasn't optimistic, they wouldn't be optimistic. So I had to actually practice optimism. I had to take a hard look at myself, how I live my life, the things that I do, and make sure I did things to stay optimistic in the face of adversity. And this was in the face of a death. And, you know, my previous wife passed away. Oh. And I read the statistics about people when they lose a spouse and they had to raise a children, how challenging that could be, and sometimes how the children get depressed or get into substance abuse. And I didn't want that for me, and I didn't want that for my children. So I read a lot about positive psychology. And I realized, though, ancient Egypt, which is something that I believe in as an African civilization, a black civilization, mm-hmm. was really oriented to positive psychology in a very real way.
Okay.
Because Ptah Hotep said, the good life is a happy life. You are here to live joyfully, not just here to live. You're here to live joyfully. You have to raise children. You have to have a decent departure too, right? You understand? Mm. But it's all about joyful living and positive living. So there's black culture that celebrates positive psychology, and I was good with that. And my Trinidadian roots also was good with that, because we're all about being positive all the time.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so I mean, I don't know if everybody knows this, but I am certainly have huge interest in positive psychology and even just that whole approach, even, you know, thinking in medicine, even of looking at what makes people well, as opposed to like what makes people unhealthy, you know, that aspect of positive psychology and trying to keep your optimism. Did, you know, you mentioned it came from Trinidad, but when did you come to Canada then? Like, what did this happen, this need to instill positive psychology? Was it in a context of being in Trinidad and this happened, or was it in North America where there it's a different context and maybe, you know, a different environment where you're trying to overcome that?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, because I don't think of it that way, but it, you know, because it's I made the decisions as an adult. But I grew up in George Street in Port of Spain, which is actually sort of like the hub of concentrated poverty in Port of Spain. But I never felt poor. You know, I never felt poor, and I never thought of myself as poor until I analyzed my circumstances and say, hey, you know, man, you was real poor, you know. Right? But I never thought of myself as poor. Mm-hmm. And even when we came to Canada, my mom was a domestic, we were living in Ontario housing, I still didn't think of myself as poor. Going to high school, fairly disadvantaged circumstances, because my dad was in Guelph. Still didn't think of myself as poor. And in my adult life, I realized that's the most important thing, not thinking of yourself as poor, mm-hmm. not thinking of yourself as deprived or wanting. I always felt that I was privileged even when I was in the most adverse circumstances. And I think that's what's key in my own triumph over my adversity. Never succumbing to the idea that, hey, you have it real hard, you know. No, I'm privileged. As I move through life, I'm always privileged. My ancestors are with me, looking out for me, loving me, nurturing me, and I'm persevering, going forward always. Like Bishop used to say, forward ever, backward never.
All right. Amen. Okay. So that's actually really interesting where you talk about not feeling poor, because actually I grew up in a, you know, lower income neighborhood, and, you know, saw my parents do everything that they could to support me. And actually I kind of had the same thing where I didn't realize that we were poor or low income or struggling until I started medical school. Then it became obvious, right, where things stood. So I think that's a really good perspective and probably advice for our listeners, especially our young listeners. So in you trying to instill that optimism in your kids, like when you think about youth now, like what would be your advice for staying well in a context, you know, this podcast focuses on a racialized world and understanding that we live in a world that there will be challenges and barriers. But yeah, what is your kind of general advice?
So generally be optimistic. Learn optimism. If you're not optimistic naturally, because genetically you may be on that 25 to 50% of people who genetically programmed to be cynical and pessimistic, which is fine. They do well in business.
Okay.
Right? But you can cultivate or nurture your optimism by learning to appreciate the good things that you have each day. You know, I used to tell people that, you know, write letters to people. That you don't have to mail in the letters, you know, but people who are departed, people who you wish you could talk to right now, or write a sort of appreciation journal so you could note, you know, what makes this day a wonderful day or your life a wonderful life. And those things will actually carry you through as you face adversity, which you will face. So that optimism, but also learning to pray. I think it's very important to learn how to pray. No matter, you know, whether you're agnostic or you don't really take it too seriously, because you will all face adversity at some time in your life that's above and beyond your capacity to cope. And mm-hmm. prayer, you know, will guide you through. And some people think of prayer as meditation. You know, I learned to pray in Trinidad as a Catholic, but, you know, I keep it in, you know, certain boundaries and parameters. I know that the faith itself is tinged with a lot of ambivalent attitudes towards African people. So, you know, circumscribe it necessarily, but at the same time, praying is very important, as is the optimistic mindset, which actually has been found to help people better cope with trauma. Yes. And I believe that African people on that ship, on those ships, and on those plantations were the ultimate optimists, because it was century in and century out. And they managed to survive. They managed to laugh. And, you know, people see people in the cotton fields and cane fields laughing. They say, it wasn't so bad. Yes, it was bad. It was very bad. It was very bad indeed.
Horrific, yes.
But the African and those plantations knew it was crazy. And that laughing was the only way to keep themselves from going crazy. I'm telling you. And you look at, you know, so you just have these slave masters trying to justify slavery by saying, look how happy they are. They're singing and carrying on, they're dancing, and then, they're maintaining their mental health. And this was before people thought of mental health, and this was when people thought Black people didn't even have a mind. You know, that was the idea back in the 19th
well,
century.
Of course, that we were subhuman. No, I think, so you raise some really interesting points. And a lot of it is borne out now by like Western science and the evidence, right? So, I mean, the piece you say about writing notes to everybody, there's, you know, they're teaching that at Yale in the happiness course. Like that is, you know, the practice of gratitude and that helps with happiness. You know, prayer or meditation or what have you, but being able to be aware and calm in the moment and take time. Very good evidence for that, as you know. And then this piece around, yeah, just coming together and laughing and having community, smiling at another person, all of those things like increase endorphins, help people stay well. And I do wonder about that. I wonder about if we are losing some of those pieces in our ancestry or that we know from it's not only our group, but other groups that have dealt with adversity and come through. So I do wonder about that. But that's really, yeah, I think that's really good advice for young people to think about, having that gratitude, trying to stay optimistic, and finding ways to ground oneself, to be still and practice gratitude.
Yeah. And, you know, I say that, but there's one important piece of context that I like to share with African audiences, and that is there were no good times. There's no good old days for African people. As we move forward, it's only getting better. Because if you go back thinking, oh boy, things were so nice back in Jamaica 20 years, come on, seriously? Nobody studied our problems. Mm. Nobody provided us with solutions. We were on our own in terms of health, well-being. And nobody thought it was of any value unless it helped you work. And they weren't to that level of sophistication in terms of wanting productive employees, right? Because we weren't productive employees, we were productive commodities. So it only gets better. So we're going through a very difficult period now because our human rights have only been recognized for about 40, 50 years, and we've only had the opportunity really to move forward in this new context, a contemporary context, without that tremendous lack of civil rights, right? So some of the sort of challenges of integration, where we don't control the socialization of Black children so that they understand racism will come your way, racial stigma and racial discrimination are to be expected. It's not about you. Don't take it in. Don't self-harm, self-hate. Move forward. We've done it before, done it for so many centuries, and we can keep going. Now is the time to keep going.
Right.
And so that some people think, oh boy, it was better. It's never been better for the past couple hundred years for people in the West. People in Africa who were insulated from what was happening, led their lives, experienced community, experienced joy and well-being and kinship. They didn't have the same trauma, but it wasn't as good for them either because
colonization.
All of the coastal areas experienced what Ivan Van Sertima used to call, not Holocaust, but Maafa, I guess, a huge, tremendous genocidal process and experience. So much so that few people remember the scale of life before colonialism. Anyway, I know we're off track.
No. We're on track because that sets the context for where, you know, we're talking about how to stay well, but it's because there is a background and a history of what has made, you know, Black, Indigenous, and other racialized people unwell. And each of those histories are unique. And so we're talking about that from the Afrocentric perspective and the African history perspective. And so actually that I love having you here because you have that, it's not just your opinion, you have that background as far as your own research. And so your research around global mental health and Black community violence and that kind of thing is still grounded in what you just described, not your personal opinion, but your lived experience, but also that research. So actually coming back, because again, you're that optimist. So what made you decide to focus your research on global mental health and stigmatization, which, you know, the stigma is not the optimist piece. So what led you to kind of follow this path around mental health?
Well, you know, all across the Western Hemisphere, from Canada right on down to Brazil, Peru, Colombia, Trinidad, Jamaica, we have this phenomena of gun violence and Black homicide victimization, which is largely a male enterprise with young males killing each other. And it's almost akin to the suicide rates among indigenous people, which is also a phenomenon across the Western Hemisphere and across the world. And, you know, I wondered about this, and I wondered about the lack of concerted African attention to it in the late 20th century when we were experiencing mass incarceration for drugs across the Western Hemisphere, which was only fueling the violence and fueling what is interscene violence, where, you know, the victim is the person who lives next door, or in Trinidad, live on the other street. Went to the same school, you know, primary school, middle school, but live on the other street and becomes your enemy in adolescence. And in the 90s, I felt a lot of hopelessness dealing with this issue. And I wondered, where's the solution to this issue? Because there's no end in sight.
And were you personally affected, or you were working in the area, or how was that affecting you in the 90s?
Well, I knew people who were affected.
Okay.
My own, shooting in my barber shop. I mean, you know, a dear friend of mine lost a brother. He was a barber. He was shot around Christmas. I mean, like, all these things happened, but that was actually, those were the seminal type of events that drove me to the issue. The fact that the issue was across the whole hemisphere, across the Western world. In England, it was knife violence, but it's also become knife and gun violence. It's also happening in Europe, in Amsterdam and Paris, you know, wherever racialized people are, particularly racialized blacks, we have this phenomena of violence. But we don't have a solution grounded in a real understanding of what's driving the violence. Well, you know, and yeah, and that's what led me to take it up as a health equity issue and as a mental health issue.
Yeah.
You know, as well.
Okay, so let's dive into that a little bit. So definitely I want to talk about the solutions, but you've just said that a lot of the solutions are grounded in an understanding of the problem. So let's go into that a little bit deeper, and then hopefully we can spend some time on, you know, potential solutions. So why do you think there is this epidemic or this phenomenon, as you said, of violence within the African diaspora in the West?
So there's the obvious sort of answers, you know, access to guns, a culture that's sort of questionable around hyper-masculinity, where, you know, your masculinity isn't affirmed by the dominant culture, so you have to find affirmation in other ways, alternative mechanisms, because you're not getting the jobs, you're not getting the upward the promotion, you're not getting the money in a society that values money. So there are those obvious parameters. And then there's the social determinants. We actually are the most poor. We experience concentrated poverty right across the Western Hemisphere.
And why is that? Just so our listeners know why we
experience concentrated poverty.
Why do we experience it?
We experience concentrated poverty for a variety of reasons, one of which is coming out of our various socioeconomic situations of second-class citizenship and slavery. We were never reimbursed for our lost wages, lost endeavors, which actually made others rich, wealthy, and they remain privileged. Mm-hmm. So we became underprivileged, and they became privileged. They remain privileged. We remain underprivileged for the most part. That social dynamic hasn't fundamentally changed, except in Cuba, where it had a different social system because of the revolution. But in spite of the revolution, racism remained a reality in that socialist space, just as it does in the capitalist space. So that's number one. Number two, when we succeeded as we did with academia, we never rose through the ranks in the ways that one would expect in a merit-based system, as the merit-based system is prescribed to work. So in our home places, and when we migrate as immigrants, we find that hard work doesn't pay off for us as it does for other groups. So in Canada, where people have migrated with their masters and their PhDs, they have this downward mobility experience where their children are less educated than they are. So you come here with two PhDs in a household, and your child is unable to make it through high school. They don't have the determination to make it through high school. You say, what the hell is that about? It's about the fact that you cannot socialize your child in a vacuum. The society has to be with you in your socialization. That's what African people know. That's why they say every village, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yes.
Because norms don't come just from the home. Norms come from the society. It doesn't just come from the community. It comes from the society because those social relationships exist. And what happens with Black people? Because we don't come here as Black people. We come here as Trinidadians, Jamaicans, Nigerians. And beyond that,
one's
we come
ethnicity.
Here as Yoruba, Hausa, Fulani.
Whatever ethnicity is your identity. Like
that's your identity
groups.
Over there.
Just like a Greek person or an Italian person. That's who you are.
But then you come here and you discover you're Black, which is okay because you are Black. The thing is, it's not what you think it is because no one has socialized you to the idea, the negative ideas that's deeply embedded in the Black idea in Western civilization. That idea is so powerful, the under expectation, the low expectation, so significant, that if you're not socialized to expect it, it can be very overwhelming, as it has been for many people who live in the suburbs as well as in the inner core of our urban areas, you know.
See, what you said there really resonates with me because, so I grew up in Montreal, so like in the 90s and 2000s. And what I saw was a lot of people who had, you know, older people had their degrees, particularly in the Nigerian community. And so people, some of them, you know, didn't just come with their degrees. They acquired degrees here in Canada and studied. But we didn't, as young people, see them getting jobs, right? So not only is there that vacuum, you know, like, or that issue of, you know, socializing your children and helping them to understand the context, but it's also as a young person seeing it happen in real time. And it was only years later, I read the study that was published at McGill University, where they said, you know, for a Black person with a graduate degree, they had the same unemployment rate as a non-Black person who was a high school dropout.
Yeah.
So when you see that as a young person, it's not very motivating to stay in school. Now, I did, but I can say that from the kids around me, it was not motivating, right?
Yeah. And what makes it problematic in terms of cognitive dissonance is if you're socialized to believe that we're all equal. You do A, you get an A. You do B, you get a B. You do C, you get a C. And the reality is you do B and you get a C. You do B work, you get a C.
Yes.
You do A work, you get an A minus, a B plus, or a C. You even get an F sometimes when you do what's expected because protective factors doesn't work for Black people the way they work for other ethnic groups. And that's a hard reality to accept. But once you accept it, you can overcome it. But if you don't accept it, you can be stymied in your efforts to move forward by it because, you know, you could lose heart, you know. Why bother? If I do this, they're going to think I'm a criminal anyway, or they're going to pigeonhole me anyway. Why bother?
Right. So you lose that motivation.
Yeah.
So then how do we go from that, which is, you know, it can be a discouraging space, but as you said, it can be overcome. And then how do we go from that to gun violence then?
Yeah. So gun violence, so I could speak of it from a statistical point of view, because 2/3 of the problem is what you expect it to be. Low income, poor housing, highly concentrated disadvantages. But then there's about a 30 to 40% of the problem that occurs out in spaces that you don't expect. The people are fairly middle to high income. The housing situations are, you know, middle to high income. Their family situations are fairly, you know, nuclear. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, single mother, precarious living, all that kind of thing.
Right.
And yet still they're succumbing to the violence.
So living in the suburbs, the quote-unquote good family, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you're seeing gun violence in these suburban communities. Yeah.
So what I think is that racism acts through the determinants in those concentrated areas that drive the violence among the Black community, the same way it did in Scotland and Glasgow amongst poor whites. But then you have affluent areas where there's higher levels of violence among Blacks. And what's driving it there is racism, systemic racism, and the inculcation of that racism in what indigenous people call collateral violence, you know, where people imbibe their ideas and they live it because there are no counter-narratives. Their ideas about what's Black doesn't derive from Black people's traditions and African-oriented understanding. It derives from media, messaging, movies, right, music, and there's a lot of negative messaging in those dimensions, those areas.
So the young people internalize
particularly
those stereotypes.
The
young males internalize those stereotypes that they see on TV or in hip hop or on
they gravitate
wherever.
Towards it, But one of the key things is around respect. Because they don't get respect from the society at large, they don't get respect from authority figures at large, they won't accept disrespect right. from one of their peers. And that's the bottom line. That's their bottom line. And that's why there's a lot of irrational acts of violence, which are spontaneous. And for there's no rhyme or reason for the quick escalation to homicidal activities. And that's what happens.
So you're saying that it's not all gang violence? Because that's what we tend to hear in the media, right? With regards to young Black youth and, you know, even the approaches to carding and harassment from the police. It's largely been, the narrative has been that it's gang-related violence. But you're saying these are just random acts?
There's a large proportion of random acts where people don't even know each other and the situation escalates to violence. Or, you know, you stop at a traffic light, two guys look at each other, staring down, and next thing you know, out comes a gun and, you know, that kind of stuff. But the person who did the most academic study of it was a woman named Sarah Thompson at Ryerson. She did a study from 1988 to 2003, and she accessed coroner's reports, right. which I wasn't able to access for the subsequent years. And what she found, yes, only about 15% of the actual homicides were related to illicit activities. 85% of it weren't, quote unquote, crime related. It was crime. It was violence related, illegal gun related in terms of gun violence, right. but it wasn't related to drug trafficking per se, but perceived disrespect.
So then, this is a really complex problem because it's not just, as you said, it's not just poverty and living in certain neighborhoods or neglect. You're seeing this in affluent neighborhoods. It's not just gang related or who wears what color, but it's about really people, you know, young people just being really quick to literally pull a trigger in situations where they feel disrespected. So in that, where we have that kind of complex context, how then do we move from this situation to solutions then?
Yeah. So, and that range amplifies according to the neighborhood you live in. There's a few neighborhoods where the risk is even much higher. So, you know, you have to have a range of responses, which includes sort of the interventions, the acute interventions to de-escalate situations, to prevention and education, to mobilization of the community, and mobilization of the community around some key ideas that are very different from the discourse and the narratives you hear now on the radio or in the media. One being, what's wrong with the youth? And that's a very common narrative you hear every Sunday if you listen to some radio programming. What's wrong with them? What's wrong with the society that produces young people to do these things?
Yes.
One of the things that we have to understand about Black gun violence per se is that Black people don't own gun violence. The society owns Black gun violence. And the solution resides not just in Black families and Black communities, it also resides in the society. And one of the things we got to dispense with is the idea that it's our problem. It's Black people's problem. Yeah, it is. It's Black people's responsibility because you got to deal with it. Your children, especially your male children, bear the greatest share of risk. And so you have a responsibility to do what you can to safeguard their lives. But you also got to understand that unless the society is on board, it'll never be solved. And as long as the society takes a hands-off approach the way it does now, in the sense that the idea is promoted that it's a Black problem. And it's not even discussed, it's implicit. It's not explicit, it's a Black problem because the way race is complex, you know, it's just the assumption, the implicit, it's a Black problem, Jamaican problem, Somali problem. But something in the society, the stigma in the society, the social relationships which drive public stigma, which leads to self-stigmatizing and self-stigmatizing behavior, is the problem, and it has to be addressed as a public problem, a public health problem, as opposed to a criminal problem. And that's a real problem for us because the Black struggle has advanced through focusing on the good victims. We've always, our leaders and our advocates have always picked cases and individuals who could stand up to public scrutiny because they knew.
Yes.
You can't just pick a victim like Rosa Parks on the bus. You got to make sure she has a clear record. If you
yes.
pick Rosa Parks on the bus, make sure she doesn't drink alcohol, take drugs, has a criminal record, because all of that will be used
To discredit
her case.
Yeah.
So we've always looked for good victims instead of, and so we have a sort of a good victim idea built into the process. And here, for the first time, we actually have people who aren't good victims, for the most part, because some of them are violent. And so we actually have to decide about valuing our young men, knowing that they're not all hopelessly violent. And we need to actually decide and work with those who can be rehabilitated. We need to have a rehabilitative approach to people who have been involved in violence and sort of help them, grow them, raise them through alternative trajectories. But we got to take this stuff seriously because we have so many poor young men as well as other income young men who have been trapped into those ideas and attitudes and behaviors and culture that it's really problematic for our advance as a people.
And so when we think about these types of solutions at a societal level or community level or individual level, like do you know some examples? Because I think what I often hear in the media narrative is as if these kids are doomed or they're meant to be violent or that type of thing. That is not my lived experience. My experience growing up with, you know, boys who ended up in the game or who, you know, carried, was that they were like smart kids who lost hope or didn't have resources and that kind of thing. So I see it very differently. But what does the research show? What works?
One person makes a difference. If there's one person, one of the problems with us, and I, it's a culture, you know, we our parents always say, you know, I didn't send you to get in trouble with the police. Do you expect me in court? And they don't show up in court. And when that's a big problem, because when you don't show up in court, the judge thinks nobody cares. And that's almost like a sentence in itself. And so it's very hard for our adult, rooted in African and Caribbean traditions, to go that extra mile and go to court and show up in court, because we have a very tough love kind of tradition going on where I didn't send you, I tell you not to use drugs. How much time do I tell you not to smoke marijuana? You're still smoking. Right. They're ready for smoking. What do you expect?
So then they're fed up and then they might not show up.
And that amplifies the negativity of the trajectory.
Because you've got to understand
that the war on drugs has been a war on black people. And the things that other groups have gotten a pass for around cannabis especially, we haven't gotten a pass for. The problem is that it's led to violent trajectories for some, and produce real criminals to some extent in terms of the criminalized behaviors that have emerged over a course of incarceration. The question is, how do we sort of break that down?
Yeah, and actually, how do we prevent it? So, you know, one example, so I spoke to Director X, right? So he is a film producer who you know, wants to pilot a program teaching young people to meditate and teaching the teachers, right? So building that kind of capacity within the schools with regards to prevention so that people aren't going to be as, I guess, quick to have those, what did you call it, when you park at the red light kind of situations.
Moments.
Yeah. So those impulsive moments, right? But I think people are looking for like programs and solutions way before you get to the point that you're going to court. So you know, what are your thoughts on that? And are there other examples?
Yeah.
Like what has worked as a society, if we're going to do this as a society?
Afrocentric education, properly developed and delivered, works. It works to reduce anger levels. It actually works as an anger management tool.
And what's Afrocentric education?
Well, you know, understanding not just what happened during slavery, but also what happened prior to slavery and the various cultural traditions that we are bearers of, which gives you a lot of cultural self-esteem to be able to recognize the hollowness of much of the public stigma around black people, particularly like around crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is a completely wrong stereotype, stigma. It has nothing to do with African people, because all African societies value law and order, good government, or what have you. In fact, they're some of the most strictest pre-colonial societies in the world, right? So you need to know that. You also need to know that in every area of endeavor, African people have been there, laid the groundwork, laid foundations. You're not a beggar at any table. One of the problems is a lot of the reasons why people don't want to approach calculus, STEM. They feel this is something. This is not an African endeavor, and they're completely wrong. And they need to be informed about that to know that these areas, these arenas that Black people have played dominant roles in, and they're fully equipped to move into those areas. So
Afrocentric education, and is that for the whole class or just? It would be for the Black
For at risk, you know, so it's what they call targeted universalism, where everybody gets it, but then there's a group that's most at risk that gets a more intense dose.
Okay.
And actually, the thing about mindfulness is for those people who may be natural pessimists. Mindfulness actually strengthens their capacity to be optimistic in the face of challenges. So that's how I believe mindfulness works. Not by itself, but what it produces in terms of an optimistic approach. But that optimistic approach will be short-lived if it's not grounded in your understanding of reality, and that means the Black reality, that African people have been able to take that and create something magical out of it, which is our interpretation of what Blackness means, not the Blackness that comes from Western civilization, but the Blackness that's reflected in jazz, reflected in gospels, reflected in the drumming traditions that one finds in Brazil and Jamaica and Trinidad that have survived years of illegality. Because, you know, it used to be illegal to drum.
Yes, the talking drums, because it was a way of communication. Yes.
So the fact that it has survived is a miracle in and of itself. And not just it survived, it actually survived in the technique survived, the musical notes, the way we do it survived.
Right.
Because, you know, it's like, it's very important because some of those deeply negative attitudes towards African people persist. And, you know, it may not be explicit and conscious, but it's there. It's like the monkey thing. So you know, you go to a hockey game, you go to a soccer game, you see them in Europe throwing
bananas
on the field. What's that about? If you don't know what you're about, you'll think that's about you. But when you know who you are, what you bring, what's been taken from you, and how you still manage to survive, it's all about them. That had nothing to do with you. And that's what you can't ignore it.
Right.
And that's what we do. We ignore it. We ignore this monkey stuff, you know, and in mental health, words matter. So if people telling you you're a monkey all day long, and you never thought about it, because nobody told you, this is what they come up with this idea to make you feel that you deserve to be a slave. Even though you have very little in common with monkeys beside our genetic endowments, which
of all
we all
human
share.
Beings. Yes.
But in fact, physically, African people actually have fewer, quote unquote, gorilla or chimpanzee characteristics, but that's lost in the public imagination because of that deep embedded association of us with animals. But you gotta know that you have withstood this on every level. You have withstood it intellectually, because this whole idea of your cognitive deficit doesn't make sense. You have withstood it morally, because this whole thing about being criminal and being dangerous, it's not new. But for the first time, we're accepting it on scales and levels unknown. And one of the reasons is partly because it's your early life that really matters the most. And I think that's where our resources need to be invested in. So we have to make sure that from 0 to 5 or 0 to 8 or whatever the case may be, our children know they're valued, know they're capable of anything, know they're beautiful.
And that their lives matter.
And that their lives matter.
And so I think that actually gives us a number of solutions that we can look to. So I'm wondering, what gives you hope when you do this work? Because there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of things that need to be done that aren't being done. So what gives you hope?
So what gives me hope is the knowledge that that interaction makes a difference. And that's why I said, one caring, conscious, creative, credible individual matters. And they matter in terms of communicating a message. You are valued. You have potential. You have creativity. You can overcome anything. But you gotta have a purposeful idea about what you want to do. And this come back to the where we started off around optimistic thinking. One of the most effective strategies is around purposeful living and purposeful work, purposeful something.
Yes.
You got to have something to be purposeful about. Whether it's rap, whether it's basketball.
Feeling that you have a purpose.
Yeah. And that's and one of the things I do in my interaction with young people is try to instill a purpose or nurture a purpose or amplify their purpose, whatever it may be, wherever they may be. And we can all do that as adults.
Right.
You know, and that's how we survive, because for a couple hundreds of years, remember, our children didn't belong to us.
Mm.
Right? And the reason that we survived that is that other people stepped in as parents when you lost your parents.
Right.
And no one was there to parent you. And so you were on some plantation and somebody stepped in to parent you.
There was the village, really, that there was that community and that support.
Yeah.
And so we do have the potential to bring hope and joy to others.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to narrow it even more for my other most favorite question, which is then, because you're bringing joy to others, you're bringing hope to others. What brings you joy?
What brings me joy, funny enough, is my role and responsibility and being able to do the things I want to do for myself and for my family.
Oh, I thought you were going to say carnival. But
oh yeah, my music and dancing brings me a lot of, is my release from the stress. Walking is my release from the stress. I take pride in my cultural releases through, you know, soca, parang, carnival, what have you. But fulfilling my roles and responsibilities bring me joy. And that one of the reasons that's important is because a lot of our males lose their sense of possibility because they're unable to fulfill their roles and responsibilities, and so they turn away from roles and responsibilities. But what the literature says is you could find alternative ways of fulfilling your roles and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Don't succumb. Be flexible in understanding your roles and responsibilities and be open to reframing it. As long as you can carry and help your family to share the burden equitably so that you can move forward as a unit, you're good to go. You're good to go. And a lot of people give up because they aren't prepared to be flexible like that. But we have to be flexible because the system isn't developed to sustain us. We have to sustain ourselves as African people.
That is a beautiful end for this podcast. Thank you,
my Dr. pleasure. Akwatu, my pleasure. Kenti. All right.
The Race, Health, and Happiness podcast was created by Dr. Onyi Norum, and she's our host. The show is produced, written, and edited by yours truly, Dr. Carl Cabasell. Our technical producer is Obadiah George. Associate producer is Shamipe Oni. Original music and our theme song composed and performed by Gold Keys. If you're looking for a little slice of audio happiness, you can check out his music on Spotify and YouTube, or get the links in our show notes. That's Gold Keys, all one word, ending with a Z. Do you have questions, feedback, ideas to share? We would love to hear from you. You can connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at RaceHealthHappy, and check out the show notes for links to the research that was referenced in this episode, as well as other bonus material. Our website is racehealthhappiness.com. And thank you for listening to Race, Health, and Happiness. Please subscribe to us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. I'm Dr. Carl Cabasell, and we'll talk with you soon.